Hi, I'm Jerry Ellis, host of Talking Apes, and this is a spoiler alert. You won't get many of those on Talking Apes, but you're about to hear one of four podcasts in our exclusive Talking Apes World Chimpanzee Day celebration. As we take a deep dive into the making of Chimp Empire, the new Netflix nature docuseries, we will go behind the scenes with the folks that made it. So before listening much further, I really encourage you to watch this extraordinary four-part series, Chimp Empire, and then come back to our exclusive Talking Apes World Chimpanzee Day event, where we'll dig into the details of the characters and the events creating this amazing series. Okay, there's your spoiler alert. You've been warned.
Who are we? How did we become the way we are? As humans, we spend our lives trying to understand ourselves. But sometimes it feels we're too close to see clearly. That's why we love stories from other worlds. In the world of chimpanzees, so similar to ours in some ways, but so different in others. Tells us stories more revealing than you can imagine. Stories all the more powerful because they are real.
Welcome to our exclusive Talking Apes Behind the Scenes, conversations on the making of Chimp Empire, the extraordinary Netflix four-part docuseries unlike any nature film you have ever seen. This episode features our conversation with Chimp Empire's creator and director, James Reed. James has had nearly two decades of chimp film experience, from Disney's motion picture Chimpanzee to his own Rise of the Warrior Apes, and now Chimp Empire. And in between, we'll squeeze the Oscar-winning documentary My Octopus Teacher, on which he co-directed. Chimp Empire captures in astonishing film detail the complex lives of the largest wild chimpanzee group known, over 200 chimps living in the secluded Ngogo Forest of Uganda's Kibali National Park. Stunningly filmed and thoughtfully written, and narrated by Academy Award-winning actor Mahershala Ali, the story centers around an alpha male named Jackson and the community of the central group. Moving between moments of great tenderness and the intimacy of family life to the brutality of all-out war. It's a story of individuals too, each one unique in character, each with his or her own ambitions, hopes, and fears. A friendship forged and loyalty lost, and all the societal hierarchy, benefits, and struggles that come together with such an intelligent and emotional ape like us. And now, my conversation with director James Reed. Hi, James, and welcome to Talking Apes. I'm so happy we finally tracked you down and were able to put this all together. So welcome to Talking Apes.
Thanks very much.
Obviously, we're going to be talking a lot about Chimp Empire today, the new, how do we refer to it? Film? Docuseries?
Series. Documentary series, yeah.
Documentary series, okay.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about the new documentary series on Netflix. First, I just want to, as I'll play fanboy for a moment.
Go ahead.
It's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, as a filmmaker and photographer of Great Apes for 40 years, And having worked with both wild and rescued chimps in sanctuaries, when I started watching this film, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is so different, so beautiful. And I was a little pissed off that I wasn't part of the film crew.
I appreciate that. That's very kind. I mean, obviously the look at, yeah, I mean, we can go into it, but you know, the look and everything obviously was achieved by a fantastic team of camera people. But I'm delighted that was the impression you got anyway.
Yeah, and we'll dive into some of the specifics of that, because for those, I think, who aren't camera people, aren't directors and producers of stuff like this, it may not be quite as obvious, but I think it's really critical to what you made and what and the story that's being told. So we'll dig into that. And that kind of gets me to where I wanted to start today was, I guess our role as communicators is, and I think this, you can tell me if this was or wasn't, but our goal is to try to tell a story and that not only engages people and enlightens them to what chimps are, but maybe gives them that aha moment where they step back and they go, I had no idea that's what it was.
Mm.
It was interesting because I was talking to my wife this morning about it, and she had two words that she kept bringing up, and it was dignity and respect.
Oh.
And it reminded me of, there's an American writer, Henry Beston, who wrote something called The Outermost House. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but in 1928. And there's a famous quote, and I'll just, a couple of things. We need another and wiser and perhaps more mystical concept of animals. We patronize them for their incompleteness, for their tragic fate, for having taken a form so far below ourselves. And therein we err. They are not brethren. They are not underlings. They're other nations. And I think
it's pretty profound.
Yeah. And I think that's what you did with Chimp Empire.
Wow. That's very nice of you to say. Obviously I'm extremely proud of it. I think what we managed to do, and of course it's all open to people's personal interpretation, you know, hopefully people do have different reactions to it. But I think what we definitely managed to do was to sort of truly immerse the viewer inside the chimpanzee group and to a degree inside the chimpanzee mind, as far as it was sort of appropriate to go to. And that was our sort of one of the overall objectives. You know, it sounds very simple, and maybe you could say this about almost any film that you're trying to do, but we wanted to get as close as we possibly could. And I mean obviously we were required to be quite close physically in the geography of the location, but we just wanted our perspective to be as close to theirs as possible, so that you sort of really felt like you were with them in those moments of their lives. And there's lots of things that sort of contributed to that. But I think that's something, even though we got very used to it, I think it's still, I can still feel that. I think we really achieved that. It's very immersive. People sort of feel like they know what it's like to live in the Ngogo troop.
You definitely achieved that. And there's this sense of sort of fly on the wall, or as I said to Ben Sad, director of photography and cameraman on this, he said, it's like, you feel like you're a mosquito following these chimpanzees through the forest while you're doing that. And that in itself was an amazing achievement. It's not something many have accomplished, or anyone has accomplished as well as this film does.
Well, I think broadly that's sort of always the intention. You know, I don't want to suggest that, you know, we had an ambition that I think most natural history filmmakers, that's sort of the intention, is to bring you into that world, or as close to it as possible. I think where we were successful with the Ngogo chimp, sort of, it really does begin with a lot of research into exactly who the chimps were before we ever got out there. And the sort of foundation of that is our relationship with the Ngogo Chimpanzee Science Project, especially John Mutani on this series. But we know and we're friendly with all of them and had worked with them before. And it was, you know, the early phases was just a lot of sort of really trying to sort of understand what they knew and get as much information about the individual chimp characters and what they were up against and what was at stake for them long before we ever entered the forest. So I think, relatively speaking, as a team, we had quite a strong appreciation for sort of who those individual chimps were and what mattered to them and what they were trying to do. You know, there's a danger in sort of trying to understand what they're thinking too much because you can't ever know that. But based on what we know of their objectives at certain life stages or certain personality types within the chimpanzee troop, you can get closer to who they are even before you're there. And I think that, you know, people who, you know, make documentaries about human characters or write dramas about humans, you know, they spend a long time thinking about or studying or researching those human characters' backstories, their backgrounds, because it really forms a good understanding of who they are and how they might react to certain situations. So as much as was possible, we did really deep research, and it was, you know, I say we did as a team, but particularly the co-writer and story producer, Matt Houghton, who I worked very closely with, he really buried himself very deeply into each of the what we could glean of each of the sort of life backstories of every individual chimp. So that was an important stage in our process. We sort of like intellectually we were a bit closer to them and what they wanted and who they were. And I think there were many stages after that, and it sort of it affected everything from how we built the teams, the personalities we selected for the film crews and their attitude to the chimpanzees themselves and the stories that we might be able to tell, and also all the camera equipment and how we were going to operate in the forest, because it was our intention from the beginning that, you know, we wanted to tell the most dramatic story that we could. I mean, I think I would say that it's true of me and it's true of the whole team. We're documentarians and we're interested in animals, but we're storytellers as well. And you know, and we get a real kick out of that. And that's not to be confused with sort of imposing story on animals. And I think that's where the, you know, there's a fine line between deciding what your story, what you'd like your story to be, and then filming towards that. Now, we never did that. We wanted to remain completely open and sort of let the chimps tell the story. And it was a true documentary in that sense. And we documented it with a sort of highest level of authenticity. But our sort of eagerness to tell good stories meant that we were receptive to moments and characters and events that we knew would make engaging stories that people would really, really enjoy and find very emotional and would connect to them.
Yeah, that reminds me of something that Ben said in our conversation. I said something about being the director of photography, and he says, well, you're working with chimps, you're not really a director.
He's right, though. Like, you know, there's, and certainly on the sort of on the acquisition side, if you like, where we capture the footage, there's limits to what you can direct. You know, you can direct camera techniques, you can direct shot sizes, you can focus on certain things and hunt for shots that will support those things that are unfolding. But there's a limited amount of, you know, compared to other subjects and other genres, you can't direct as much because, you know, they're in complete control and you're following them and documenting what's happening. It's an exercise in observing and recording. You know, the camera team, I mean, Ben was absolutely fantastic, but there were there were eight of them in total, and all of them brought incredible sort of skill and creativity to what they did. So, you know, it's not just sort of hit the button and see what happens. There's lots of decisions in how to film something and where to focus as a scene is unfolding naturally and organically. But he's right. Things are going to happen that you can't possibly control. And the best thing you can do is try and get in the best positions to record them.
After our conversation, I was thinking, yeah, you're not really directors of photography. You're almost reactors of photography. As a storyteller, from that perspective, why this is so impactful to me and the people that I've spoken to and the people that have written into Talking Apes with their comments about the show, knowing that we're putting this together, the impression is so different than any other natural history story. And so from that standpoint, it breaks with the genre of natural history storytelling, which is, you know, you often go in and there's this sort of laid out script. We want to tell the story of the lions living in the Serengeti, and they're going to have to hunt the wildebeest or the zebra, and they're going to have a set of cubs, and we're going to watch the cubs grow. You know, there's this whole almost a linear path in which we're going to follow this animal versus this, which was much more, as I've heard people refer to it, as much more like a Tom Clancy political novel mixed with a reality TV show.
I think, you know, I know exactly what you mean about sort of natural history generally. I mean, I would say there are examples of other innovative natural history storytelling and focusing on individuals. So we're not unique in that sense, but it's rare. It's partly the combination of the sort of the style of storytelling. So the way that we've sort of assembled it and presented it, but also the Ngogo chimps, that particular place, that particular group of chimps, you know, it was incredibly sort of like productive from a dramatic storyline point of view. And we sort of knew that before we went in. So
maybe you could, for just a moment, talk about Ngogo. You did, you know, a few 5 years or I think prior to this, you'd done Rise of the Warrior Apes. So I don't know if that was your first experience with Ngogo.
Well, it kind of was. I worked about 10 years ago, actually. I worked as a field producer on Chimpanzee, the Disney Nature movie. And one of the, you know, I was not a director or writer or anything on that film, but I worked in the Ivory Coast for quite a long time. So I've spent time around filming chimps quite a lot in the past. And Ngogo was one of the locations where they filmed. And it was one of my jobs to go through all the footage. So I never went to Ngogo, but Bill Wallower, who's a famous and fantastic chimpanzee cameraman, he'd spent many months, several trips at Ngogo and had shot a lot of material. So I was logging in, trying to sort of decide where the best shots were and who were the most interesting sort of characters. And that was my first sort of real exposure to Ngogo, the Ngogo chimps. And I absolutely love, just from looking at footage of them, I just love them. And one chimp in particular, I sort of fell in love with. And in some ways, it really was the beginning of a sort of a love affair with Ngogo as a whole that's lasted many years and probably will continue for many years. And John was...
Who is that, by the way?
Pinsir, the chimp's called Pinsir. And all the Ngogo scientists will roll their eyes at me talking about Pinsir again. Actually, they all have a special relationship. I mean, he's died now, sadly, but they all had a special relationship with Pinsir as well. But I think they always thought I was sort of like really doubling down on why I thought it was special. But, you know, in some ways, it was an interesting lesson in sort of connecting. Like at that point, I was the viewer. I was a fresh audience looking at the Ngogo chimps for the first time, and one individual chimp just stood out to me. And there was something about his sort of behavior, his demeanor, his appearance that just was just gave me a sort of funny feeling. In like, it was a bit eerie in a way, but I felt very connected to this one chimp. And I hadn't sort of noticed initially why that was. And then I sort of spotted that he had white sclera, like you and I. So most chimps have the dark iris and the whites of the eyes are actually quite dark. So their eyes are subtly different to humans, despite all the similarities. But Pinsir had almost sort of perfectly human-looking eyes. And it, for me personally, it changed. It had a real change in sort of how I connected to him. I just became a bit obsessed by it, actually. And at the time, I think I emailed, I think it's... with Tomasello, who was sort of like either responsible for or connected to the cooperative eye hypothesis, which is about the unique role of human eyes in sort of social evolution. I've got a degree, but I'm not a scientist. So I'm probably like, I'm oversimplifying it all here, and it's quite a long time ago. But I became a bit obsessed by it. But then it kind of went away. But when the opportunity came up to do a feature documentary about the Ngogo chimps and the history of that project, and that was, well, when I say an opportunity came up, I sort of, it had never really gone away in my mind, and I sort of discussed it with Keo Films, who I sort of knew and was doing some work with in Bristol anyway, and we sort of developed it together and then pitched it to Discovery. And it was all based on the archive. And all these things are contributing to what ultimately ended up being Chimp Empire. And I'll try and get to it quickly. But the David Watts, Professor David Watts, a Yale scientist, he'd been out at Ngogo since the very early days. So in about 94, 95. And for his own personal record, he'd taken around a little... DV camera, mini DV camera, and just recorded things. And he was sort of just interested, like video data. It wasn't really part of his study. It was for his own personal reasons. It became relevant when he recorded interesting things and shared it with the other scientists. And it became valuable as a scientific record. But that wasn't really the intention, I don't think, in the beginning. But he was out there with a tiny camera, filming all sorts of interesting stuff. And he would just shoot the chimps all the time. Over the years, he was not only was he recording events that nobody knew happened with chimps and certainly that hadn't been filmed before, but he was also recording life histories of these chimps over years. So, you know, he built up this library of material that sort of documented the sort of changing lives of the individual chimps and of the sort of changing circumstances of the whole group. And it was across a period where the Ngogo chimps were expanding and growing and expanding and began dominating their rivals in the forest. So he recorded great change for the Ngogo group as a whole, but also for all these individual characters whose sort of fortunes were changing throughout that period as well. So... this is just this incredible tranche of archive. I got in touch with David. We had a bit of a chat about it, and I went to visit him at Yale. And because he basically never logged all the footage, he had it in sort of dusty old boxes in his office. And he knew what was on there, you know, and he's a fantastic memory and things. And he dived into the odd tape here or there, but there was a whole load of stuff that he hadn't seen since he'd filmed it years previously. So I sort of sat and went through it all and spent months trying to work out who was who and sort of select down this footage to see the lifelines of certain individual chimps and all these unique events that affected them. And that formed the base.
When was this that you went to?
That was like 2000.
Is this before Rise of the Warrior Apes?
This is for Rise of the Warrior Apes. So this was this was when we were developing the idea for Rise of the Warrior Apes. And the archive forms the basis of the, you know, it's a historic story. The archive is the main thing in that film. And the scientists are the storytellers. So they talk through what happened and what they observed. And there's this amazing video record of almost everything that they saw as well. So it was incredible. I absolutely loved that experience. And the process of just understanding the history of Ngogo and the individual chimps, but then also spending so much time with the scientists who knew them best and getting their versions of the stories and using their interpretations of what happened and the individual characters, you know, they narrate the entire film. It was an incredible experience, and I loved it for just what it was. But it also, after that film, again, I'd fallen properly in love with everyone who worked there and all the chimps at Ngogo. It's just fantastic and a great privilege. But also I came away thinking, well, David, like, races around the forest and, like, you know, he's extremely fit, David, actually. He's very fit and strong. There's that. But also the reason why he gets, and he knows the chimps and he knows the forest. So there's all sorts of advantages he has for getting access to things. But also the main thing is that he's carrying around a camera that you can fit in the palm of your hand, and it weighs, you know, half a kilo. He's able to see things and be with the chimps in a way that film crews are not normally able to do, that because our equipment is just too heavy and too cumbersome. So although it evolved, and Ben Saad will claim he carried a heavy backpack, he didn't, he's just not very strong. But the principle for chimpet, part of the beginning principle was, if we're going to do it right with Chimp Empire, if we're really going to be there for the majority of their lives and see things, not just get glimpses, but actually be there for everything. And we'll do it for a finite period. But for that year, which we decided, or a year and a half, we just want to be there for everything. If David could film it, we want to be able to film it. We don't want to be watching what David films at the end of the day thinking, well, why weren't we there? Well, because we were knackered, because the camera's too heavy, or the tripod was stuck in the mud. That was sort of the original principle. We spent a long time, let's say this was, I can't remember when it was, but we, one of the first meetings Ben and I had, because I'd worked with Ben on a few things before, and he and I had spent time at Ngogo and Warrior Apes, so I thought he would be brilliant. And he's not just technically very good, which he is, he's got a fantastic eye, and he shoots very, very beautiful images, but he's an extremely nice guy as well, actually, and that does make a huge difference. And he sort of got on very well with the chimp scientists when we were there last time. He was genuine. He's genuinely fascinated. He's a real observer and a listener, and he has a scientific background. So there's lots of things that he was just, yeah, he was the first person I thought of. So I went to talk to him initially, and we sat in a car park somewhere between our houses. It was locked down. I can't remember where Ben lives, but somewhere out in the city.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. You were like met in a car park 6 feet apart, and you said, hey, I've had this idea during COVID.
We did, and it was chucking it down with rain as well, and we couldn't sit in a car. So we were sort of in this under a tree at some point, just sort of very depressing and weird. Anyway, talking about it and talking about that sort of principle, like how small could we go while still delivering sort of 4K beautiful images? Like if that were our objective, to go as light and as nimble as possible, that's where we need to start out. So we did, and he was up for it. And so that sort of formed the basis of the beginning of the sort of technical approach. Now, I won't bore on about it, but we went through several stages. In the end, the cameras are not anything like as light as David's, because of course it's a spectrum of compromises, and you know, bigger cameras, often you can see further with bigger, you know, a bigger, heavier lens will get you closer because it can see further. So all of it is a bit of a 3D sort of like compromise, as you know. But we did end up with rigs and cameras and lenses and a way of shooting and a team that allowed us to keep up with the chimps much better than I ever had previously. So I think that's the outcome of that objective. No, we never quite managed to do it on the little cameras where you could race up hills. They were, it's carrying heavy backpacks around and things, but we did have relatively lightweight tripods. We had relatively small gimbals and the cameras were reasonably light and the lenses were about half the weight of the more conventional natural history lens that would be used in that situation. So we definitely went a lot lighter. So even though didn't achieve the goal of like being virtually weightless, it still had a huge impact on our access and our ability to film more of their lives on a day-to-day basis than had previously been possible.
The first thing when I saw the footage, you couldn't even have done this when you did, Rise of the Warrior Ape. I mean, the technology has advanced so quickly to these small, lightweight. And of course, Netflix has its own parameters for what you have to shoot with to even allow it to be on their programming. And I assume that you already knew that this was going to Netflix when you started this. Did you have the green light from them or did you?
We hadn't got the green light at that point. And when we did all the camera tests and things, we hadn't had the full green light, but we did know that we knew that we were going to take it to Netflix. Yeah, we were sort of gearing up to go there. So we had that in mind. We were just, trying to be confident and hopeful about it, but we hadn't actually been green lit at that point.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, dig a bit deeper into some of the details of filming Chimp Empire, including not only the challenges of creating a film this immersive in chimp life and culture, but also touch on how a film this visually extraordinary would not have been possible just even a few short years ago. But first, let's check in with assistant producer Demel Zaban.
Hey, Jerry. Hey, everyone. Well, firstly, a very happy World Chimp Day to you all. Can't think of a better way to celebrate than talking to the amazing Chimp Empire crew. Jerry and I have had such a fun couple of weeks recording these fascinating conversations, haven't we, Jerry?
Yeah, we definitely have, and they have been brilliant. We can't thank James and everyone involved enough, including the folks at Underdog Productions, and a special shout out to Gabby at Netflix for all of her help. Demelza, it seems like a lot of Talking Ape listeners have seen this amazing docuseries. So what have folks been telling you about Chimp Empire?
So like us, of course, lots of our listeners are major fans of this series as well. And many of you wrote in with your comments. Leandro said it was an excellent documentary. Lily said it was great. But I admit I was sad to see that they snack on monkeys. I also love learning about their social hierarchies and how grooming is their conversation. Sunny wrote in about My Octopus Teacher. So if you didn't know, that was also co-directed by James. She said, I absolutely fell in love with that movie. For me, it was just further proof that we can build meaningful relationships with other creatures. Plus, the ending just had me. Completely agree with you, Sonny. That film is just profound. It's beautiful. It always makes me cry. Jerry was laughing at me yesterday because I'm very lucky to live by the sea, and I told him that I go down there every day and try and look for an octopus friend, but I've not had any luck yet. If you'd like to get in touch with us or just keep up with our work, we're on nearly all of the socials. Search Talking Apes Podcast or head over to talkingapes.org and there's a contact form on there. Thank you for all your brilliant questions that you sent in for the Chimp Empire team. As always, we've had too many to read out, but we've picked some of the best ones, and Jerry is going to be asking James Reed one or two of each of those across these four special episodes. So if you don't hear your question this time round, listen out on the other episodes, it might come up. And now back to Jerry and James for the first of those.
Thanks, Demelza. And here's a question from Zoa McKenzie Stoddard. How much does a chimp's cultural upbringing determine its personality? James?
Ooh. Again, hard to say definitively. And I like, although I slip into chimp expert mode just because I've been around them a lot, I'm not a chimp expert. I'm not a chimp scientist. So I'm just going to give my view on that. I think they're complex creatures. They are a product of their genetic makeup and the environment in which they grow up in. And you know, for instance, the really clear examples of that is that chimps who are orphaned, they tend to get cared by other chimps in the group, often males actually. So the females are more likely to be focused on looking after their own young, but because the adult male chimps don't play any role in the care of their actual offspring, orphans are often taken care of by adult males. They grow up different. I mean, you know, the Ngoge scientists would say that there's just some defining qualities with the orphans. They have a different time of it. And so that's quite an extreme example. But I think that there's different styles of parenting with the different female chimps as well. And you can see that clearly illustrated, even just spending a small amount of time with them. Some chimps are more protective of their infants than others, and some have older siblings who play a greater role in their day-to-day activities, and that has an impact on them as well. And each of the little chimps is a different personality themselves, and that comes through at a really young stage. So I think a lot of what sort of, you know, partly their innate personality and who they are, but everything that happens to them in their childhood sort of or in their early years has an impact on them, and that will be how they were brought up by their mother, and the interactions that they had with the other chimps in the group will all contribute to a slightly different chimp personality, I would have thought.
Wow, that was an awesome answer. You actually do sound like a chimp expert. Thanks for the question, Zoya. And now back to our conversation about the making of Chimp Empire. But that's why I think the backstory is so important and so interesting for people to hear, because this didn't just go out in the forest and shoot 3 or 4 hours of footage and put this thing together. It sounds like it started 10, 12 years earlier as you were hearing about Ngogo and working on the Disney production of Chimpanzee and beginning to build this. And then, of course, equipment evolves throughout this whole thing. So you've now got cameras that can actually film in the dark, and they're small and lightweight.
Well, that was significant. The Canon cameras that we went with, our principal cameras, had sort of dual, it's getting a bit technical this, but it had dual ISO that meant that basically the contrast in the forest was no longer a problem. Now, that was a huge issue 10 years earlier, dealing with a very dark environment, but when spots of light do come through, they illuminate little patches or wet leaves that just would blow out, and your camera wasn't sensitive enough to pick up the dark parts of the forest and the highly reflective wet leaves in the same shot. You just couldn't cope with that range of exposures. But on UCAT, I mean, we barely had any problems with that. So that was a completely new thing. We're actually so much more of the city. So we were keeping up more, but then also more places we pointed our cameras in the forest, we were able to get really high quality shots. Whereas previously it was hard to keep up. The equipment was heavy. And then even if we were there, the lighting was making it very difficult to, you know, chimpanzees typically have very dark fur, black fur, a lot of them. It ranges, but they're dark in color. And the forest is dark, but then you get these annoying shafts of light that like can sometimes look amazing, but quite often just make the camera freak out and it can't cope with it. That sort of didn't exist anymore. And this incredibly sort of fit, young, ambitious team of camera people marching around the forest, just like, we got so much material. Like you say, like, yeah, in the end, there was 3 hours. The series is made up of four parts, but the total's about 3 hours. That comes from, God, I can't remember the number of hours, but, well, hundreds and hundreds, you know, 500 hours of footage, I think, probably we got over the year and a half. You know, four camera people every day, virtually, and they were shooting about an hour's worth of material every day. Now, a lot of that is you know, you're filming things when things aren't necessarily happening. But with chimps, you never quite know when it's going to change. So you have to film the downtime, because that downtime could suddenly become very relevant. Like anything can happen at Ngogo or with chimps. Generally, you know, it can seem like quite a calm moment and they're grooming and sitting around and nothing much is going on. And you could be forgiven for thinking, you know, I'll just sit back, I'll have my sandwich now, nothing much is happening. But that can just change. And it can become the most significant day that year. And for multiple reasons, you know, they could suddenly be attacked by another group or something. And you never really know when that stuff's going to happen. So we were filming on the basis that you have to, in order to capture the moments that you can't anticipate.
If it was from purely a behind the scenes perspective, that I would love for people listening to this to understand is that's where the directing comes in. That's where the planning comes in, is finding a way to film where you can use almost all the footage that you film, you know, rather than some of it going out the window because it was all blown out or was all crappy. Mm. And it sounds like it's a technical thing that doesn't have anything to do with the film, but it has everything to do, because you don't know when that moment is going to be special that you want to be able to make sure you grab, or it's a tiny little intimate scene between a mother and a newborn or something.
You're absolutely right. That's where you can exert some control over things, is being able to film the things that you can't plan for, being in position to film the things that you can't script, and then knowing how to handle those things once they do happen. And so all the work happens around the edges, because the chimps will just do whatever they do. And you just want to be there and be able to record it. But there's a lot that goes in and influences your ability to be there and record it. And that, like I say, that sort of starts months before you ever go in the field, trying to find out as much as you possibly can about every individual chimp at Ngogo, so that when you do encounter that chimp, you kind of know who they are and what they've been through and what they might want on any given day, or how they might react when another chimp that you also know and have read about and learned about arrives in the same scene. So having that sort of knowledge that, okay, we can't control anything here, but we can anticipate a little bit about what might happen here, and therefore we can get in positions and be thinking in our heads, well, we know that these two chimps don't get on, and they're of an age and of a state, you know, position in the dominance hierarchy or whatever it is, that this could be uncomfortable, and therefore we can get in positions to sort of record how that unfolds. Or we know that, you know, I mean, tragic stuff, you know, there was the, you know, females who had lost babies that we sort of knew are going to be affected by that, and therefore are going to have a slightly different attitude to their maternal role as well. And, you know, and also you learn to be sort of sensitive about that as well. So just knowing what had happened to the chimps in their recent and deeper past was also, it wasn't just that it made us better able to record or predict how they might react in a given situation. It also just makes it more interesting for everybody as well. And that is a big part of the job too, is if everyone's really engaged in who they are and the history of these chimps and what stage of life they're in, they're more receptive, they're more alert to things that could be relevant. You know, if you know who that chimp is, really, based on what the scientists can tell you about them or what you've seen in years of David's archive, then you understand that you relate to them a little bit more and you're more interested. And so everybody, it's not just for me and the writer Matt to do that, also the whole camera crew. It was, you know, having them really engage in the individual characters, it makes them better able to record them, but it also just makes the whole experience more interesting, and they live it and they love it. And I think that was a, you know, that wasn't a strategy of mine, but in hindsight, the fact that we all sort of like fell in love with the details of their lives and wanted to know what was happening, whether we were filming it or not, that I think you feel that in the series, that people documenting these chimps care about them. And I think that on some level, in some intangible way, you feel it in the images that they capture.
Now, Ben talked about that in his comments about the fact that, you know, if there's another one, he signs up already. He's ready to go back. And and I jokingly, you know, I thought, well, maybe that's why you called it the Chimp Empire. So now you can do The Empire Strikes Back as a sequel.
Yeah.
But that might be copyrighted. I don't know. You might not be able to quite use that. Speaking of planning, I deviate for just a minute. You did this during COVID. A lot of researchers were actually shut out of being able to go in and even do their work. You know, we've talked to on this podcast, in addition to John Matani, who was, you know, a advisor on this thing and you worked with, but people like Martha Robbins, who was up in Bowindi as a guerrilla researcher, and some of the folks over in Karasoki and with the mountain guerrillas in Rwanda and further afield, even, you know, in Borneo with orangutans and so forth. And people were shut out. How did you manage that? Because you shot this in the midst of COVID, didn't you?
Well, not quite, actually. I mean, the production kind of bridged COVID in a way, in that, but we were developing the idea, or first, like I say, the meeting with Ben happened sort of, I think, really early in lockdown. But Matt and I had been sort of developing the idea and thinking about it conceptually pre-COVID. So when we had no idea pandemic was around the corner, and we're sort of thinking and planning it, and even having conversations with John Matani and the Ungogo scientists about how it would work. So there's quite a lot of, we'd actually reached a stage in quite a late stage in development in terms of the sort of like what we were going to try and do and the access and the approach and things like that. So we hadn't actually, I met Ben, well, Ben and I sat down about it a bit later on in that process when we started to get into the detail of the cameras came a bit later. But we were actually developing it and had spoken to Netflix about it before we got locked down. And then suddenly lockdown happened, and of course the whole world stopped, and obviously nobody could sort of fully green light anything or make any firm plans to go out, because we just had no idea when anyone was going to be able to travel again. John and David and Kevin, who run the Ungogo Chimp Project, they're all based in America, actually. So they were locked down in America, so they couldn't be there. But the Ugandan scientists, the Ugandan scientist Sam and the field researchers and trackers who were out there, they were able to be at Ngogo. So there was still people at Ngogo and keeping an eye on the chimps. So we were still getting information about what was happening and things. And then I think it was, we were just waiting for the restrictions to lift and for it to be legal. I mean, you remember, I mean, it's all a bit of a blur now, isn't it? But like things sort of, we crept out of lockdown a bit. Like things started to ease, certain countries started to open up. And then there was like, you were waiting for these moments for the Ugandan government to say, okay, you can now fly here. And they accepted flights from some places, but not others. And I think it was okay to fly from the UK, but not America at one point. So virtually as soon as it opened up, we were ready, and Netflix had commissioned it, and we went straight in. We as a production sort of built a quarantine camp outside of the Ngogo territory, but close by. So we flew in, traveled near the forest, and then stayed there for a week and sort of got tested two or three times for COVID. And then once we'd done our 7 days and nobody was symptomatic or tested positive, then we moved in to work with the chimps and stay in the camp, which is right in the middle of the Ngogo chimps territory. So yeah, we sort of bridged it in a way. There was definitely a hiatus. We couldn't go and film during lockdown, But we could continue to sort of work on it independently and exchange ideas and read up about backstories, for instance, and start discussing camera techniques and things. And in a weird way, because we had that break, it gave us this time where we couldn't film. So to be productive, we just really dived into sort of, well, how are we going to maximize the absolute best sort of camera setups we can? And we just read more and more and more about the backstories of the chimps. And so it forced us into concentrating on things for even longer that really were valuable to the series.
Talking about those backstories, did you guys, because this series is so different looking, but also different feeling than normal nature piece of, you know, again, it feels like, I hate to use this word, a reality TV series, but I mean, it is a reality. It's probably the only one that is actually a reality TV series out there. Going through David's work and all that film that he had, and the way that people like David Watson, Matani, John Matani, and Kevin know these chimps, did you create from that footage, or just in words, sort of dossiers on each of these, so that the cameraman had those to read? They had, like, here's my folder on Gus or Jackson or, you know, Christine or whatever. And they could actually turn to that and go, okay, this is how they deal with this. This is how they look at this. This is how they react to this chimp, this chimp, this chimp. Did you develop anything like that?
Well, we did. I mean, like I say, this was largely the writer, Matt, who really dived into those backstories, and therefore, and as soon as we'd established the backstory, we started to look forward to try and predict what those individual characters were up against, what they were likely to experience or likely to be trying to do over the period we were filming. And Matt really got involved in that in a very detailed way. I mean, we both did, but really it was him. And he had these incredible sort of spider charts with all the sort of relationships with the different chimps and things. So if anyone ever wanted to know, oh, who's the brother of, you know, Pork Pie or whatever, like, Matt would just, you know, he had all these charts and sort of genealogies. And all that's based on the Ngogo scientists, and particularly Kevin Langegraber, I think, who did a lot of the genetic studies. So again, it's just the resource. It all came from the Ngogo scientists giving up all this sort of information to us. And then we would sort of process it and think about it in terms of value to the storytelling. And knowing who was related to who, and also all those sort of detailed backstories, which then might help us predict what happened next. Matt, in particular, was sort of processing that for months. And he's a very good storyteller. He's a writer, but he's very good at consuming loads of information as well. And doing research. So he just bury himself in that. And then we'd talk about, well, what possibilities does this give us in terms of telling stories about these different characters? And we did create sort of like, well, these are the things that might happen to Burgle over the next 18 months. And these are the things to be alert to. We, in the end, we gave quite summarized versions to the camera teams. You know, what we didn't want to do is overload them with too much sort of information. And also, we didn't want it expressed as targets, really. You know, it was good for us to know, and it was good for them to know a bit, but I wanted for them to find their own feeling of those characters and also be open to, even though we think Burgle might do this and that would be great, if he does something completely different, you should be equally interested in that. And so, you know, and we knew, well, Joya is a good example, for instance. We sort of knew Joya, she was 10 years old, so actually we knew a bit about her, and we knew that she was related to Jackson as well. She's Jackson's sister. So we always thought, oh, Joya's, and she lives on the West. So, like, that's an interesting character to keep an eye on. But we didn't think she was at the age where she'd be emigrating. Talking with the scientists and looking at the data, and we felt, nah, within our time period, that's not likely to happen. And we also, there's like quirks to her personality that we didn't anticipate either. we knew she was we knew she was an orphan, so we knew she was like she was a bit quirky and did things a bit different. We were interested in her from day one, but it really took, yeah, particularly Callum and Ben Cherry, the other Ben, who did the first shoot in the West, and they fell in love with Joya. And really, once they were in love with Joya and just filming her all the time and suddenly getting details of her character were coming out, then suddenly she became a really interesting character for us to follow. And then things happened to her that we couldn't have anticipated. So that was quite a good example of there needed to be some flexibility in the system. Like, we had all this knowledge, but what we didn't want to do is stick rigidly to specific characters that we had anticipated would give us the best stories, or to have people targeting things that we couldn't really predict. So it was a balance of like, well, look, here's some information about these characters historically and what we know they could be doing, but go out there with an open mind and, you know, you will relate to different chimps. And when one of the camera people really relates and sort of loved and saw something in a chimp, they tended to get really interesting stuff with them. So we always sort of kept that flexibility in the system.
Coming out of that conversation with Ben, that the two words that popped to mind were autonomy and trust. It's something that he talked about that you gave them. And he was incredibly appreciative of that. I hope I'm not burning him in the future for using that.
That's really good. Yeah.
He really felt that from you. And it shows in the film, I think, because like you said, you can't have a clear linear path with chimps. They're going to do their own thing. And you had to really trust these guys in the film, because I assume that you weren't in the field the whole time.
No, well, not nearly as much as they were. I mean, I went out for short, relatively short spells at the start of shoots when the new, because we had kind of two crews that we sort of piggybacked to shoot for a couple of months and then go home for a couple of months, and then the second crew would come in their place. So I went out at the start to sort of help them get set up and be there with them as we were experiencing the forest and try and, you know, share some of what we were thinking and what we should be receptive to, but also to try and sort of breed that sense of sort of creative autonomy that I felt from the beginning, particularly as a sort of, you know, it's a multi-character, multi-perspective approach. So I felt it was going to be useful for sort of camera people to find their own enjoyment out of it, to be sort of following things that really interested them, and that would naturally provide a different perspective to what another camera person was doing. I mean, I think at times they probably felt like it was a bit aimless and lack. I think there were definitely calls I had from the field where they were like urging me to give them some stronger direction, and at times, you know, it wasn't all no. This is all part of the strategy. I just didn't know either. Like, who should we follow out of this chimp and that? This chimp, this is happening to this chimp, but we hardly see them and they're hiding here. And then this chimp's happening to them. So which one is more valuable to us? And I'd be thinking, you know what, toss a coin. At times you just have to pick. You've got, you know, a choice of two different chimps or two different parts of the group to follow. There's no real right or wrong answer. You can't be everywhere at once. So go with your gut. So I was often sort of saying that, but I did feel confident at the time that actually by cultivating trust in their own judgment and going with their own sort of instincts in the field was kind of essential, because even if I could have been there all the time, I couldn't have been with every camera person all the time, because there's four out. And also it's being over their shoulder and sort of telling, oh, you should probably get a tight shot of that now. It's sort of it's not my style, actually. There are people who direct like that a lot, and they're brilliant, and people really enjoy working with them. It's not my style at all. I don't feel useful in that situation. I feel more useful for how I do things, in sort of like finding a sort of a common way to approach things generally and cultivating a sort of alignment in what we think is interesting, because you can never quite know what's going to happen. But if you've sort of got similar tastes in what's interesting and valuable to the story, then you know that in that moment they're going to choose to do something which is sort of similar. You might choose to do that as well. So I think it's nice that Ben said that. I mean, we have our fraught times, Ben and I. He's extremely difficult on a personal level, but he's a fantastic comfort. Now, I'm pleased he said that, and hopefully they all felt like that. And there was, they were sort of directing their own camera work on location for the vast majority of time.
I think your approach is, I think it's necessary for what, you know, have, again, going back to my own experience in filming apes and especially chimpanzees, who are, you know, the term fission-fusion is used with them in, mm-hmm. in the groups, but it's sometimes it's their personalities throughout the day. That's why they are so like us. You Absolutely. Can wake up in the morning and they're really sweet, and by afternoon they're trying to rip your head off, you know, not literally, but they, but you feel like they're looking at you like that, like they're not pleased with you being there. So working with a crew like that, is, had any of these guys had that kind of experience where they would have this autonomy and they would have this flexibility from a director?
I don't know. You know, other than some of the directors I worked with when I was an assistant producer, you don't really get to see how other people direct things. And when you're a bit more junior, you're not really keyed into how things are happening, particularly. You're quite a passive sort of observer, or at least I was, probably not paying attention. So I don't know, but they seemed to, like I say, there were moments when that sort of level of autonomy unnerved them a bit. And I think a lot of camera people, you know, they want guidance, they want direction. And at times it probably felt like I wasn't giving them direction. Not that it was some sort of like secret, strategic, long-term direction, which it really was. It was thoroughly thought out. But at times it probably felt like they maybe didn't have enough guidance. I don't know. But I think largely, and that was sort of the feedback I got, I think largely they sort of like, okay, so I can kind of choose and figure that out myself. And if I want to shoot it a bit more like that and use that lens when I'm in that situation, I can do that. And I was like, well, absolutely. You're the people. You've got to be comfortable with how it's being shot. So I'd always talk to them about it and what I thought was, because I think giving people, you know, I think what camera people are nervous about is, well, they can make those decisions, but then if ultimately you don't like that way of shooting, you won't use it in the edit as much. So that's the risk, I suppose, that they think, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense to me, but if it's not the style that you're going for, then I end up shooting this all day and you don't even use it in the edit, and you use the what Ben's shooting over there. And like, I wish I'd known that. So I think that's the sort of conversations they always wanted to have. They wanted to make sure that they were maximizing the chances of what they're filming turning up in the final films. And that's totally understandable.
The style is something that I'd love for you to comment on for just a few minutes. And then I want to turn to talk a little bit about the story, and lack of better word, call it anthropomorphism, of giving these chimps the character and, as I said in the beginning, the dignity and respect that you give them. But in terms of style, you have a basic idea of where you want to go with this in the beginning, but the story threads need to develop based on the characters that you've chosen. Because if I'm not wrong, there were over 200 chimps, right, in to choose from. So that's a cast of characters that you have to figure out. And now you start following these, and some are developing and some aren't. So I assume you're getting this film back from those guys every few months or something. And now you have to go through it. And you and I guess you and Matt are starting to look at storylines in his big spider web of things.
Yeah. I mean, it was more regular. I mean, we basically, we had sort of updates and access every day, really. We kind of knew what was happening.
But you're not seeing the actual film.
No, I mean, I was out for the first few weeks that we filmed on the first shoot. I was there. And even in those first few weeks, I think we made quite a few decisions about together about techniques that were working and characters that we should pay particular attention to. Gus is a good example. Christine and her baby is a good example. They sort of emerged as characters when we arrived. We knew about them and we'd considered them and we knew their history, but we hadn't really, you know, the final piece of that is getting a feel for them in the field and, you know, feeling what they're giving off as a sort of personality, or is their appearance really recognizable? And like Christine and Gus are really good examples of that, that actually when we arrived and we didn't know this was happening, Christine had just had her baby. So that felt, right, well, this is right at the start of that first year of life. Is not only is it fascinating from a developmental point of view, but also it's a risky period as well. And only 50% of infants sort of make it through their first year. So we thought, you know, well, people fell in love with Christine quite quickly. She's very, very sweet and sort of she's very tender with the baby, but she's got a little edge to her. She's interesting. And just, yeah, seemed like a personality we all sort of like related to and recognized. And we got some early, even on the first day we ever went out, we got some interesting footage with her. So that just immediately encourages you that, like, okay, we've already filmed a glimpse of her sort of life and get a feel for who she is and the relationship with her baby. And then we knew she had another daughter. But again, until you see Nadine and how she looks as this older sister who basically isn't getting a look in anymore, until you really feel that family dynamic and see it in the rushes, you're not that final confidence to go, yeah, let's lock in Christine and her family as a major target for us, because there's a dynamic here that's recognizable straight away. It's interesting. We don't know what will happen over the next year, but we should invest, you know, wherever possible. We should film with Christine and their family, or at least spend some time filming with them, despite what's going on. And Gus was sort of similar. I mean, I'm not the only one who loved Gus, but I definitely had a particular affection for him very early on. I just thought he was really recognizable, and he was often very obviously to the side and socially isolated. And again, everything you read in textbooks, chimpanzees are social creatures. Well, here was a chimpanzee who was seemingly antisocial, and therefore I just thought, well, look, this is kind of he's not really doing what you're supposed to do as a chimp. This is quite an alternative way of being a chimp, and you feel for him because you naturally empathize with someone who's not sort of socially involved. It's just the most basic sort of human thing to relate to. So those are good examples of characters that we were aware of and we'd sort of studied in part of our backstory thing, but they came to life when we saw them and started filming them.
Well, that feeds perfectly into this whole idea of the anthropomorphism issue that I wanted to talk to you about.
It is an issue.
Let's just stop here. We'll do a whole new podcast about the issue of anthropomorphism.
This is a takedown.
This is.
The anthropomorphism police.
Yeah, it is.
Go on. Yeah, no, I'm very happy to talk about it.
Well, I won't pretend to be the anthropomorphism, I can't even say it, anthropomorphism police. But when we come back, James and I will dig into his thoughts on how to meet the needs of storytelling, accurate natural history science, and creating something Netflix is driven to share with the world, so that more people ultimately come to understand how amazing chimpanzees truly are. We'll also touch on the conservation message at the end of episode 4, and his thoughts on what, if any, there is a conservation responsibility to creating something like Chimp Empire.
I also want to just make it a quick reminder that this conversation with director James Reed is one of four we are having as we explore the Netflix docuseries Chimp Empire, The Making Of from Behind the Scenes. Be sure to check out the others in this series of podcasts. Our conversations include director of photography, cameraman Ben Sad, also science consultant, primatologist Dr. John Matani, and local Ugandan Diana Kamwiri, who worked as a field assistant and played a valuable role as a second camera unit camera person. And now back to our conversation with James about anthropomorphism and conservation messaging, including its role in his Oscar-winning film, My Octopus Teacher.
We broke out of that, I think, with Jane Goodall in that whole well-documented story of her naming chimps, not giving them numbers, treating them like individuals, and progressed from there. And that's exactly what David Watt did. That began this process to actually engaging with them as individuals and personalities and all of that. Yeah. And then David, which I didn't know until recently, he started off by naming them after jazz players.
Jazz musicians, yeah.
You know, because jumping back to another film you did was My Octopus Teacher. That film in some way shocked people more than this one might, because one of the reasons that we as an organization have chosen Great Apes to work with is you immediately have already bridged one gap. They look like us. By getting over that hurdle quickly, you can move on to some of the other issues around conservation and survival of an endangered species and so forth. Now, octopuses, they're out of the movie Arrival. You know, they're talking in a different language and everything. Yet you were able to make that, you and Pippa, when you created that film, you were able to make it so that we fell in love. And I can't tell you how many people I have met who will no longer eat a cephalopod, no longer eat an octopus because they never saw them that way before. And, you know, through the brilliant filming, but also the brilliant storytelling you did, you connected us, as I said in the beginning, with, you know, Henry Beston's quote, they're another nation, but we need to respect them for what they are. I guess the question is, going into it as a filmmaker, they already have names, but you're trying to give us a personality. And where do you bridge that storytelling with the science? And especially working for somebody like Netflix, who obviously not an agenda, but they want to see this film seen by as many people as possible. So they want it to be a certain level of success. And just doing a dry documentary about chimps is not going to cut it for them. So how do you do those kind of three things? How do you pay attention to the science, do great storytelling, and then hopefully attend to what somebody like Netflix wants?
Well, I mean, firstly, I would say I viewed the sort of challenges in that respect differently for My Octopus Teacher as I did Chimp Empire, actually, because My Octopus Teacher, even though the animal is much further from us in lots of ways, the story is you know, it's about the relationship. So it's about Craig's relationship with that octopus. And he is the storyteller. He is the narrator. So in many ways, it really all boiled down to what he interpreted of that relationship and her behavior. And so, I mean, I think, that was a naturally anthropomorphic, openly anthropomorphic thing. I think he was a very knowledgeable person, and you couldn't question his exposure. You know, he was there, he's seeing these things, he's recording them. So there were certain things that I think even people who are sort of cautious about anthropomorphism or even against it probably had some sympathy for the way he was, or some tolerance for the way he was describing things, because they really, you know, it was shocking in what you saw and what was actually happening. So we were in sort of new territory with Craig, and you were kind of like, well, you know, I'm going to trust Craig because he was there and there's no precedent for this. And it's something you can't really compare it. But it was, you know, it was very much, it was based on what he felt was happening or what it felt like to him. So he's immediately putting these octopus experiences into, even putting them into human words, is you've already began a translation or an adaptation of what's real. You know, it's a bit of a minefield anyway, even talking about those things. But I suppose we weren't writing the script for Craig. You know, Pippa and I were selecting the things that he said about the octopus, but that we felt were okay. And Pippa especially, and also Craig, consulted with, you know, there's a thing called an octopus psychologist. You'll be pleased to hear. And they worked very closely, actually, with octopus scientists and a couple in particular. We just wanted to make sure that we weren't including things that really contradicted what was scientifically plausible. But we, you know, it was Craig's story. He had that year. It's what he felt about it. I think we presented it as his interpretation of it, and that felt good. But when it came to Chimp Empire, very different task. We're now writing words to go along with what we've recorded and seen. And even though it is a totally authentic story and we present it how it happened and in the order that it happened and to whom it happened to, but obviously even by compressing that, by editing of any kind, you're adapting the reality. You're bringing a year down to 3 hours. So you're simplifying a much longer experience. So you're already, even if it's not your intention, you're starting to mess with the reality a tiny bit, because the reality is recorded across 500 hours and a year and a half, and no one's ever going to watch it. Well, apart from us, we had to watch it. So we had to, you know, trust our ethical standards and feel like, okay, well, the edited version, which is the four-part version, is a good representation of what went on at Ngogo in that year and a half. We stand by it. And I think, you know, we had a commitment to doing that authentically. It's a slightly different question to what you're asking, but you're already sort of going down a road of sort of like adapting things a little bit for human consumption. Now the challenge of like, well, there's things that the viewer will benefit from being explained here that will help understand the chimp's predicament, help understand what's at stake, contextualize some of the things that are happening, and we need to write a script for that. So we did that, you know, we did it in collaboration and with a lot of close work with John Matani in particular. And that's like, he came over to Bristol for a number of sessions on the scripts. And sometimes we would put things in that, you know, enhanced the sort of drama of a situation that we felt was strong, and that he would have some notes and changes to make to that. So it was a back and forth. I would say that, I mean, you're right in the Netflix, like any broadcaster or platform, you know, of course they want viewers, and that's, you know, there's no real point if nobody watches it. However, it would be misleading to say that they were sort of the only people who want that. Like, personally, I want loads of people to watch it as well. You know, I really felt with this, I wanted to bring it to a huge audience, and we all did, actually. So we're not sort of tortured artists who are a slave to the big bad Netflix who just wants to like that. What we did with Chimp Empire was how we felt it should be, and that actually is the great thing about, you know, it's true of lots of broadcasters and platforms, but our experience with Netflix was they supported what we wanted to do with it. So what we ended up with, that's the sort of broad accessible version that we wanted to make, actually. Yeah, there's times in there where we want to allude to things in the language of the narration and enhance viewers' engagement with specific things and to enhance the drama. I think where you go into quite dodgy territory is when it's not really there and where the narration is sort of like actually taking he's kind of inventing a sense of drama out of something that doesn't really exist there. And I think what we did was enhance and sort of increase engagement in the stories that were already dramatic and emotional and interesting. But, you know, there's language in there that anybody studying anthropomorphism or who's very sensitive to it might pick out certain lines and go, come on, that is a very human take on that scenario. And occasionally that's sort of what you have to do when you've got to think your audience is humans. So you're bridging a gap. You're connecting a human audience to an animal story and perspective. And I do think that actually the narration sometimes has that's the job you're doing. You're turning it, you're translating it into concepts and ideas that humans can easily understand. And sometimes that will cross a line and offend some people. But I felt like, yeah, I felt like I say, we wanted to stay scientifically accurate. And that's why we brought John so close in. But John, again, is interesting. And all the Ngogo scientists are, they're interested in public engagement too. You know, they want it to be something that can be consumed by the masses. They're very proud of the work that they've done, as they should be in Ngogo. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, Jane Goodall was like the pioneer of that. She did it for her own, you know, it was her own personal view of it, that these are sentient beings and they shouldn't be numbers. They have individual personalities and I'm going to name them as such. So it was a personal thing. But she also saw enormous value in the accessibility that creates as well. And the Ngogo scientists were similar. You know, they supported an approach that made it accessible to all.
In our conversation, John Matani, that was one thing that he commented on. You're smiling. For those of you who can't see, he's smiling right now. He said this, and he said this after you had not gone out to a pub and he was in that condition. He said one of the things that was so remarkable is the fact that James gave me the access that normally scientists don't get.
That's good.
To a production like this. And he's worked on, you know, he's worked for a number of productions that have come to Ngogo. I was interested in that because it reveals itself in the film. I mean, one of the things to me that was striking about Chimp Empire was the brevity of words. You let the visuals do the talking, and it seemed as though, and Mahershala Ali, who is the narrator, did you choose him, by the way, as the narrator, or was that?
You know what? He was, like I said, Netflix and Sarah, generally very hands-off, or they're hands-off when creative processes are going well. You know, they with people they trust and processes, they're like, you know what, we're not going to interfere for the sake of interfering. I'm sure they would interfere if things weren't going well. But that was, to be fair, she was sort of like, well, you know, you choose the narrator, but she suggested Mahershala Ali in the early conversations. So that was her thought. But I'm a huge fan of his acting work. And he's got an amazing voice. And he's an absolutely brilliant bloke as well. I worked with him a bit in Atlanta. We recorded the two of the sessions in person in Atlanta, and he was just absolutely lovely and so into the chimps and so intrigued by them and had so many questions. And so it was a real pleasure, actually.
His voice is, it seems perfect for it.
But it's
also, and this is, I suppose, to you and Matt in writing the script that is there, but it's the brevity. And like you said, you're letting the imagery talk and explain so much about who these chimps are. And that's the power of the imagery. And then the words seem to be, they're there to create bridges. It feels like bridges, as well as the music. It's not overpowering. It's very subtle, and both together, the narration and the music seem to work as bridges to connect these extraordinary images to telling the story. And that's, again, going back to the beginning when I just said it's unlike anything I've seen in terms of natural history filming. And I almost hesitate to call it natural history filming and storytelling, because it is so different in that sense. And that's where that sensitivity and respect, I think you gave the story and gave the chimps, is so powerful.
Well, I think, you know, I think we're not. I mean, I would say this probably applies to almost everybody on the team as well, from the editors to the camera people, to me and Matt and Matt at Keo as well, you know, and Callum, the series producer as well. We're all sort of a bit natural history adjacent. Like, we're not right in the heart of conventional natural history filmmaking. We've sort of been around it and know it and have a great interest in the natural world, but we're not sort of thoroughbred natural history people. And I think that, you know, that had a positive impact in this case, on this series. And I think we never set out to make something that sort of felt like anything else in the natural history genre already. We sort of set out to, you know, we wanted the stories to be as strong as you'd get in a premium drama, but we wanted them to be totally real. So we wanted it to be a sort of an observational documentary that had the sort of beauty and immersion of a natural history series. You know, the world, we wanted people to have the same experience of like entering a world and feeling like they were part of it. And that's what natural history does so well. You know, they really take you into magical places, and Ngogo is a magical place, and so a lot of those sort of natural history tools really, really help with that. We couldn't have done it if we weren't, you know, as a bunch of people, if we were non-natural history people, we couldn't have done it either. And that applies as well to the editors, camera people, everybody needed to have a sense of it and a certain amount of skills and experience in natural history. But the fact that we were, most people working on it had done a range of other things and were interested in other genres and approaches, that really helped, actually. And I think that's the sum of, you know, what you get from it is it feels like something that's it features chimps and it's in this world that you're very much in, but it doesn't really feel like a natural history documentary. And a lot of that is in the sort of the editing and the style of music and narration. And the editors were all fantastic. I mean, that is really, you know, particularly on something where you have so much material, you know, key events and key characters where we didn't have that much and they just happened and they're there. But there were so many possibilities in terms of moments of their lives that we'd captured, and therefore so all those choices about sort of how we present that and package it in the edit. And yeah, Sam Rogers did the first one. I'd worked with Sam several times before and he was amazing, and all the other three were fantastic as well.
I do want to make a brief comment about the editing and the structure there, because I've read some comments, and this is really important to me as a filmmaker as well, is that you didn't insert a lot of B-roll to fill out stuff there. I mean, one of the things that John Matami said was that you were really diligent about if that was a hand in the picture, that you tried to identify that hand as being the hand of the chimp that you were talking about. You weren't just throwing in somebody's hand at random all the time. He was really impressed with how diligent you were about that. And I've heard some of the comments that I've read online about the fact that, oh yeah, they, you know, that's great, they build this whole story, but you know, it's just a bunch of B-roll they threw in between there. And
yeah, I heard that too. I was like, right, we're going to go offline. We're going to chat about this.
Don't do that. Don't do that. You will be trolled forever.
Yep. Take a deep breath. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm really proud of that part of it. You know, from the beginning, there's no way we were going to be interchanging chimps. Like, you know, if it's a story about that chimp, there's no way, no other, we didn't fake any of that stuff. And I'm not saying that people do, but it's like with animals, like at a distance, you know, you could get away with it. You know, you could, the audience probably wouldn't notice if the close-up was of someone else's foot or hand or whatever. But I think an important discipline for us to have from the beginning was that we're going to achieve that level of coverage, and we're going to achieve dramatic stories that we don't have to sort of tinker with, because, and we need to stand beside it and say, this is just authentically how it happened. And that is everything of that particular chimp. But our level of coverage and access was so good that we were able to do that. So it didn't feel like an enormous sort of sacrifice. Actually, it felt like, well, we were around that chimp for long enough to film them in all those different scenarios, and because we had several camera people there at once, so we often were filming things from different angles and things. So actually, in the edit, it was sort of it never felt like much of a compromise. But he's, you know, he flatters me consistently. John, it's just, he's retired, so he's just drunk all the time now. Drunk and emotional. But he's too generous with it in a way, and I always tell him this, because yes, we had a very close working relationship with him, him in particular. I mean, it just, with all the Ingogo scientists, but quite early on, I think John was sort of assigned to us, or he had the time or the inclination, whatever. Anyway, John became the most involved, and he's a great guy, and we just enjoyed spending time with him and working with him. And the series was going to be better for bringing him closer to it. And, you know, you're on the same team. As soon as you feel like you're sort of on opposite teams, I just don't see how that works. So it wasn't like an act of generosity or anything, but also on a long-term project where you're going in and out and in and out and in, and your access is like constant, of course you're going to build up a bigger relationship with the people, the scientists who study those animals. I think he's maybe being slightly unfair on other productions or other directors who maybe only did like an individual shoot for 3 weeks, and then that sequence is forming is just, you know, 5% of their entire film. So that director probably can't have as close a relationship with each of the scientists of each of the sequences that they do. So, and I, when I've done that sort of film, I couldn't either. So, you know, it's because of what it is. We were doing 4 parts all about the Ingogo chimps. Well, you know, we can afford, we've got the time and the focus to have that close relationship and constant dialogue over it. So he did feel much more involved, but I think, and I always explain it to him, that there is a practical sort of explanation for that, but he just puts it down to me being just a great guy.
Okay, well, we're doing another podcast with him about his research, and I'll make sure he understands that better, that you're not the great guy that you think you are, or he thinks he is. I do want to ask you about the end of the film, and or the end of the fourth one. And I read a quote where you said, "I hope that this motivates us all to help and protect and conserve this endangered these endangered animals and the forests where they live." Two part question. One is, if you walked into a pub or a cafe and there was someone sitting there and they were, what would you want to hear them say about this film? What do you want them to walk away with knowing about chimps or feeling about chimps?
It's a hard one, that. And I think maybe other people in my position, I might have a clearer idea about that. I just want people to love it and feel like, I'd love to overhear people saying, "Oh my God, I was so engrossed in it. I want it to have captivated people." And I want people to feel like they were there and just to feel closer to them. I feel like, you know, yeah, I did say that. And of course I am a conservationist, and I'm aware of the challenges and threats to chimpanzees, but primarily I'm a storyteller, and we all have different roles to play And I think that what we as a team did was really engage people in the lives of the Ngogo chimpanzees. And I think that's the height of the ambition. Now, what people do with that connection and that sort of level of engagement is going to affect people in different ways. And yeah, of course, I hope. I mean, if you're not environmentally inclined, then you're just going to enjoy it as a piece of entertainment. And I don't think that's wrong either, personally. But at the same time, if you are, then we've just brought you closer to we've heightened your appreciation of these complex, individual, sentient creatures that then, where if you are inclined to sort of to respond or read about the challenges that chimpanzees and other species are up against, then it will hopefully increase your sort of motivation to do something about it. Some people, again, I feel like I would be criticized by some people who would feel that, you know, our roles as documentarians is to, you know, that there should be a clear environmental message in almost everything that we do now, because it's irresponsible not to. And I get that point of view, actually. And I think in some cases I agree with it. I do generally, and I found this with Octopus Teacher as well. Like we had lots of conversations internally about, you know, we've now engaged people in this relationship. We've got them. We've got an emotionally connected audience. Surely this is the moment where we go, but the cult forests are in trouble. And at that point, they'll care and it'll spread that message, and it'll really help with the conservation of octopus and other creatures that live in that ecosystem. We decided in the end not to do that and to focus more on just bringing people closer and closer. And every valuable moment was just to show how complex this creature was and how diverse and magical this environment was. You know, I don't think you can sort of get away with that for everything, but that turned out to be, I mean, who knows what would the result would have been had we had a clearer environmental call to action at the end, because we didn't do it. So you just can't compare. But it has been overwhelming, the response that the Sea Change project, Craig's project, has had. I think it's seriously impacted the octopus market out there, and in a positive way for octopus. So things can have a really profound effect without you necessarily sort of preaching. But we're getting into issues that people will criticize even what I've just said. And I just don't, on a personal level, I focus hard on the craft that I feel I can bring to it, that we as a team can bring to it. And yeah, I'm not, I would say probably I wouldn't count myself as an environmental filmmaker. That's not that I don't think it's important, but it's maybe not where my skill set is. Does that sound bad? What do you think?
No, it sounded great, because I mean, you do put up, there is a message that does come up at the end of the film, and it talks about, you know,
for some people that won't be enough.
No. Wasn't there an organization here? Click here and go to this and help save the chimps of Ngogo, right?
Or just the, you know, it's a bit late at the end, you know, to roll credits is almost like a tokenistic thing. I mean, I welcome that feedback, and I've read that a couple of times, and I think that those are completely fair comments to make. You know, there's always really difficult decisions to make about, you know, what do you, at that point, what do you want the audience to feel? And like I say, I'm a conservationist. I care deeply about these chimps. So in many ways, I'm really engaged with the sort of the conservation problems around chimps and their habitat. I'm also a filmmaker and a storyteller, and those things do occasionally come into conflict, and you are sort of, you're focused. We were so focused on trying to make something that was maximized sort of engagement in the stories and personalities and psychology, as risky as that was or is to do, that was our focus and on our ambition. And, you know, even towards the end, you know, we felt like we made quite a lot of sort of philosophical and existential sort of conclusions that, you know, that really encouraged people to look very closely at chimpanzees and what they are and their longevity and sort of what they mean to the world and to us. And so I did feel that, like, conceptually, we were sort of talking on another level, but we weren't sort of explicitly generating a call to action or really stating what the specific environmental challenges were.
Yeah, no, I agree. We feel like we're in the same boat sometimes. I mean, it's a fine balancing act between getting people to have their own aha moment and trying to hit them over the head with a sledgehammer and say, you got to do this. And we know that the second of those options doesn't typically work, or else it would have worked by now. You know, we wouldn't be living in the world conservation endangered species world that we live in right now. So it's I think the beauty of this film is, and that's why we're doing this to push it out as much as we can, is the more people have those aha moments by seeing it, and I think they will, that they will then look for options. And it's up to organizations like ours to then provide the options. Like, say, now, if you're motivated and you have had that aha moment, here's your options. You know, spread them out there for you.
It's hard to tell, isn't it? You never really know how things are going to impact people. But I think what we can feel confident about is because we designed the series to be accessible to all, and, you know, it wasn't designed just for natural history viewers. We wanted people who wouldn't normally watch natural history to find something interesting about this. And that, you know, I don't read all the social media, and some of the comments on me are just too hurtful to read. But I've read quite a lot of the feedback on Twitter. And what's been really interesting is definitely people commenting who never normally watch natural history and are saying that. And you can tell by what they're saying that they're not people who are into natural history as a genre. And, you know, just the uniformly, though, they're just like a bit blown away by the sort of complexity and similarity and sort of fascination of these like individual chimpanzee characters with all these things that happened. Like, just wow, I didn't know this world even existed and that there's such complexity to it. And so I think that is a major achievement for us. I think if there's a new type of audience who are like tilting their head, and at that moment, you know, we've just opened, you know, people who are involved in natural history and conservation and environmental movements and things might look at what we had an opportunity there that we could have really, we were really gone to town on habitat destruction and the threats faced to chimpanzees by poaching and things. But for us, a big part of it was to try and bring chimpanzees and their intelligence, individuality, complexity to an audience who really didn't know anything about chimpanzees. So it felt like we were starting further back, actually.
I completely agree. We have a motto here. It's awareness, understanding, action. And too often it's because conservation groups, I think, have jumped from very little awareness to action. You need to help. And we realized in the beginning that we had to start with awareness. People weren't even aware, as you said. I mean, sometimes people are looking, they're going to watch this and going to, I read one comment online and the guy goes, I don't normally watch nature films, but I started this. I thought, oh, I'll give it a try. I started it and I watched all four episodes that night. And he said, I had no idea chimpanzees were like this. To me, there was no bigger compliment than that right there.
Yeah.
Because that's awareness. He is now aware.
Yeah.
The understanding and the action piece will follow. If
hopefully, or maybe it won't. You know, I mean, there's no guaranteed sort of connection there. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think it's a healthy, ongoing debate. And, you know, I think natural history filmmakers have been subjected to those questions for years, you know, and a lot of the traditional response was, well, it's our job to make you fall in love with the and care about the planet and its inhabitants, and, you know, not our job to actually do the environmental side of it. And there has been a real shift, actually, and I think that a lot of my colleagues and companies in Bristol and the focus has definitely shifted towards the sort of the environmental stories that go along and along with that. So I'd say there's a big change in natural history generally, actually, and a lot of filmmakers have really embraced making the environmental challenges part of the story, and they're doing it very well. So I think overall, as the genre, actually, that change is kind of happening, and that, you know, it's no longer a faux pas to talk about climate change and to turn the camera around and show you, you know, what's actually outside the park. And so that's interesting. That's a real shift in the last 10 years. And so I think people are getting better at it. And I think it'll be interesting to see what real sort of critics or believers in that would think of Chimp Empire and what we should have done in that respect. And, you know, you can learn from it.
James, we've been going on for a while here now. I want to thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. I know you've been swamped with doing all kinds of interviews and conversations and things. And
it's been enjoyable.
But I appreciate this, and I appreciate your team, you know, all the folks that have also been a part of putting this series that we're going to release on World Chimpanzee Day.
They are a very cool team, the Chimpanpie team, all of them. That's actually been probably one of the most it's been one of the most enjoyable parts of it, the shared goal and just some really very cool people, very, very, very good at their jobs, very hardworking, but also just a great range of personalities. I think everyone's had a lot of fun on there. I mean, it's been thoroughly enjoyable as well. I think you never quite enjoy something that goes out that you didn't enjoy making, actually. And I've done that before. I've worked on films that I didn't really enjoy making, and there were problems with it. And no matter what it turns out like, you can never quite look at it the same. And I think we'll forever as a team enjoy Chimp Empire, because it was just a lot of fun to make. And it was very sort of inclusive of everybody involved. I hope everyone feels like that. I mean, you know, I don't know, and some of them probably wouldn't tell me if there were problems with it, and maybe it's, you know, I enjoyed it anyway, and then they all pretended they did. So, but all the way through from start to finish, fantastic team, and just a really, really good, enjoyable process.
Great. Well, this has been enjoyable as well. Let's stay in touch. Cool. If you make it to wherever I am in the world right now, Portland, Oregon, west coast of the U.S., or if I make it over that direction towards Bristol or something, we'll find a pub and a pint. Absolutely. And keep the conversation going.
Absolutely. I'd love it. That would be great.
All right. Take care. Cheers.
Cheers.
I want to thank James Reed for sharing his wonderful behind-the-scenes look at creating Chimp Empire. You'll find links to Chimp Empire, including images and additional video footage from the film, on our website at talkingapes.org. You've been listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Our conversations are with folks from across this planet of apes, writers, researchers, conservationists, scientists, and filmmakers, all getting us closer to understanding who we are and why. Because ensuring the survival of the other four great apes is the only way to ensure our own. I would like to thank our entire Talking Apes team for all the work they do in bringing this podcast to you. And I would like to thank you, the donors and Patreon members who make Talking Apes successful through your generous support and the sharing of this podcast. If you appreciate what you hear on Talking Apes, consider supporting us by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. And finally, I would like to thank the dedicated folks on the front lines of great ape survival. We hope through Talking Apes we're able to shine a light on the incredible selfless work you do every day to ensure great apes, primates, and their forest homes survive and thrive into the future. I'm Jerry Ellis. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing with your family and friends the Talking Apes podcast.